Can pumps help control uncontrollable diabetes?
Drugs for neuropathic pain.
What should we do about coronary artery stenosis?
And smoking cessation therapy.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 11th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of Texas Tech University Health Science Center, El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, with all of that, let's turn directly to the studies. And why don't we start with this idea that sometimes diabetes is almost uncontrollable, regardless of how many medications we use. In The Lancet this week, a discussion of whether infusion pumps can help.
There are several factors that contribute to uncontrollable diabetes. There's a failure of the pancreas to make insulin. That's due to death of what are called the beta cells. And there's also insulin resistance. And those things can make it very difficult for people to control their diabetes, so that more than a third of patients who end up starting insulin end up using more than 60 units per day, which is a lot of insulin. When you give insulin, as is typically done via injection, it's slow to absorb and the availability is reduced. So the question is, for these individuals that have poorly controlled diabetes despite high doses of insulin, what other therapies do we have available? Well, there are newer oral agents, but about a third of the time when patients start those, they don't tolerate them because of intolerable side effects. Bariatric surgery is an option, but that can't be offered to everybody. Particularly the older individuals may not benefit as much. And a third option would be, instead of giving insulin as intermittent injections, perhaps if we gave it via an infusion pump, that could do a better job. And that was the question this study attempted to address. It took 331 patients with poorly controlled diabetes, and they randomized them to continue with their injections, testing their sugar at least three times a day so they could adjust their daily injections. And another group actually received continuous infusion pumps. And what they discovered when they followed these individuals over the six-month time period, those that had the continuous infusion pumps lowered their hemoglobin A1C by about 1.1%, and those that used the intermittent injections by about 0.4%. So the continuous infusion was more successful in controlling the diabetes. And it did it without increasing the risk of having a low blood sugar, that is hypoglycemia.
Okay, so we've talked about that other pump that utilized glucagon as well just a few weeks ago. Seems to me that these pumps are maybe finally coming of age with regard to the management of diabetes.
They certainly have seemed to show a benefit in terms of lowering blood sugars. So the question is, what's the cost effectiveness? And this study doesn't address that. And that's what future studies need to do.
We know that, of course, no doubt, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, that as economies of scale are achieved, this cost-benefit analysis, I think, would probably tip in favor of the utilization of pumps.
And that's true with most new technologies. They're expensive to start with, and then they get less expensive as we incorporate them into our medical care.
Okay, let's turn from here to Annals of Internal Medicine, something that we've been talking about for a long time. Carotid artery stenosis, narrowing of that big artery that goes into the head and provides that critical structure, the brain, with blood. And what do we do when we look at screening for that particular condition?
Now, since stroke is a leading cause of death and disability in the United States, in fact, it's estimated that 7 million adults have had a stroke. The question is, how do we prevent that? There's a lot of attention focused on screening. And what the United States Preventive Services Task Force, USPSTF, attempts to do was to gather all the recent data and answer the question, does a certain screening technique or prevention technique help prevent serious diseases like stroke? And on the basis of their analysis, the short version is that they are not recommending screening for asymptomatic, that is people that have not had a stroke before or people that have not had a mini stroke, so-called a TIA. They're not recommending screening in people without symptoms. Now, you might take a step back and say, whoa, how in the world could you not recommend screening for stroke? I mean, it's so prevalent and it's so disabling. And they do that on the basis of several things that we know. The estimate of asymptomatic severe carotid artery stenosis is pretty small. In the general population, the estimate's about 1%. And the second thing is, well, when you do a test that's not 100% predictive, what's the likelihood when the test is positive that it's a true positive? Well, when you have such a low prevalence in the population, 88% of the time where it looks like the test is abnormal and suggests there's a severe blockage, it's not there. You take it to the next step. What would you do about it in someone that doesn't have symptoms? Could you actually prevent a stroke by doing surgery, for example, or putting a stent in. And we know that when you do carotid artery surgery, so-called a carotid endarterectomy, that within the first 30 days after the procedure, there's about a 2 to 4% chance that the person will actually have a stroke related to the procedure, and a 1 to 2% chance they're going to have the heart attack. All in all, they say screening's really not recommended.
Well, that's kind of too bad, isn't it? Because I can recall getting all excited about this low-tech method for screening for potential carotid artery stenosis, just using a stethoscope and listening to the blood as it flows through that vessel.
You know, the reason why I thought it would be important to talk about this particular topic is if you go on the news, you go to health fairs, people will recommend screening. They'll give you basically a low-cost screening. They really play it up during Mother's Day and Father's Day. How could you not get this for your parents or for your loved ones? And that's why I think it's important for our listeners to know that it's really not recommended by a source that's really looked at the data critically.
This, of course, calls into question for me, or calls to mind for me, the idea that when we talk about blood vessel stenosis in the body, the most critical ones, of course, and maybe the ones that are going to demonstrate a problem first are going to be the coronary arteries.
It could be manifest in the heart. It could be manifest in the neck. The important thing is that the risk factors are the same for both. If you want to prevent strokes, the issue is not screening for asymptomatic carotid artery disease. It's controlling the high blood pressure, controlling the diabetes, controlling the high cholesterol, exercise. So that's much more effective than screening.
You segued us very nicely to our third study. Let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association and talk about another risk factor for both heart disease and stroke. That's smoking. Can we help people to quit by utilizing a couple different things together?
This is a really important topic for the reasons as you mentioned. It's a significant risk factor, not just for lung cancer, but for carotid and coronary artery disease. And once someone's already in the habit, how are we best able to help them with smoking cessation? Pharmacotherapies that we have available include nicotine replacement therapy. And we also have drugs that interact with the nicotine receptor. The one that's approved by the FDA is called varenicline or Chantix. Well, we know that either of them is effective, but can they be more effective if combined? Then that was a particular question this study attempted to answer. 450 subjects that were cigarette smokers randomized them to receive varenicline with a patch that had nothing on it, or varenicline with a patch that had nicotine on it. And they followed these individuals for the course of 12 weeks. That's when they received the therapy. And then it was stopped, and they followed them for another 12 weeks. And what they discovered was the individuals that received combination therapy were much more likely to be abstinent from cigarettes totally. So at 12 weeks, combination therapy, 55% versus 41% with varenicline alone. And then at 24 weeks, 49% with combination therapy were abstinent versus 33%.
So let's talk about the side effects, of course, because Chantix has received a number of warnings from the FDA, and people complain about suicidality potentially with regard to this drug. So how long do we have to stay on this stuff, and what about that particular issue?
These individuals were treated for a total of 14 weeks, and the individuals that received varenicline alone were more likely to have abnormal dreams and headaches than those that received combination therapy. What I'd say is for the individuals that are going to receive varenicline, it looks like combining nicotine replacement therapy with it is much more effective than varenicline alone.
How interesting. That suggests to me that there's some relationship with nicotine withdrawal potentially that might be a mechanism relative to the risk.
It's interesting that you bring this up because they asked the individuals whether the combination therapy decreased their craving for nicotine compared to varenicline alone, and it didn't appear to do so. So the rational biologic explanation of why the two together is better than either one alone isn't really known at this time.
Well, but a good note to Benny for folks who are going to attempt to quit smoking to try to use those two things together. Let's turn to our final one then. And that is, again, a very, very common problem, neuropathy, often secondary to diabetes, as we've talked about before. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, do we have any medications that can help?
That journal has a series called the Clinical Evidence Synopsis Series. They looked at 10 Cochrane reviews that include 91 randomized double-blind trials looking at different medications that were used to treat patients with various neuropathic pains. These are patients that either had diabetes, shingles, or individuals that had fibromyalgia. There were over 18,000 adults in these different types of neuropathic pain studies. The medications that were best studied were gabapentin and pregabalin. But the disappointing thing is actually a minority of individuals received significant benefit. Patients that received 50% pain reduction or more. All in all, it was less than 25%.
I guess this is also important because we've got this huge pendulum swing back against the prescription of opioids for pain. So taking a look at these kinds of issues is really important. What are the alternatives? And I would also just muse on the idea that there are new pain medications that are right now in clinical trials that work by vastly different mechanisms. So maybe one of those is going to come across the transom as something that we can use.
And as we learn more about that, we'll make it available to our listeners.
Okay. On that rather sobering note then, I think I'm going to talk about the screening for asymptomatic carotid artery stenosis this week on the blog.
Again, I remind our listeners that all the articles are posted and obviously Lives with Highlights 1.
Excellent. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.